Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Studying the various structures and functions of the brain is complicated stuff. We may be able to picture it all, but most of us would be hard-pressed to identify the lobes or the role of the hippocampus or the various parts of a neuron. Now, a pair of neuroscientists has created a visual, story-based guide that aims to make brain exploration exciting and understandable for a variety of ages. Dr. Matteo Farinella and Dr. Hannah Roche are authors of a beautifully illustrated new graphic novel called Neurocomic, and they join us together from England to tell us more about the project. Hello, Matteo. Hello to Hannah.
Hello.
Hello.
So going from the lab to the drawing table sounds like a pretty big leap. Wondering what possessed you to create a graphic novel about the brain, and what was your goal in this? Hannah, let's ask you first.
Well, when we were working in the lab together, we were both fascinated by neuroscience, and we felt that it would be a great opportunity to have a wider public audience be able to be interested in the neuroscience behind it. So we wanted to make it more accessible, and we just wanted to make it fun, really, because at the moment neuroscience can get quite heavy in the lab. And the way to do that was, we thought, to do a comic book.
So what was the division of labor here, Matteo?
Yes, I was the one drawing. So for me, actually, it was not a big leap. I spent many years dividing my life between science and comics. Mostly I was doing science during the day and comics at night. But in this project, I finally found a way to combine them. So for me, it was really great. I actually never hoped to do that.
Do you consider yourself an illustrator first or a neuroscientist second, or is that distinction even made?
I find it really hard to make it. I guess professionally I'm a scientist, because I always study science, and I was doing a PhD in neuroscience while writing the book. And I think I'm deeply inside, like, very scientific. That's what they tell me. But I also love to draw comics. Yeah,
very artistic as well. And there is a sense of adventure here. Now, one may think, okay, a comic about the brain, it must have anatomical diagrams. But it really is an educational adventure story. Hannah, is that the way that you see your research in the brain? An adventure?
It's an interesting way of putting it. I guess when you're doing research, it is all about discovery and about almost sort of having a narrative and a story even within the science, because that's what sort of drives you forward to answer questions about the brain. So in a way, even being a scientist in the lab day to day, it is about an adventure. Sometimes also I find that science can be quite constraining. So actually, an even further adventure, or like a leap from that, would be to do something more fictional, which is how we decided to go with Neurocomic, so that it was more of an adventure and more fictional than real science, because in real science you're obviously constrained by evidence and facts.
So for people who are listening to this, how would you sort of describe or give me a synopsis of this adventure that takes place in the comic?
Okay, well, it's really, as we are saying, it's an adventure, a sort of trip through the brain. Like, I was really thinking about the old classic education books, which are always kind of a trip. There is this unwilling character that finds himself in the brain, and he's just looking for a way out. But along the way, to find a way out, he needs to learn about the brain and interact with the brain and the scientists who are studying it.
So he goes through this forest of neurons and meets these characters who tell him about their study on the brain. So we meet these very important kinds of brain scientists and go into these kind of rooms where things are happening. In fact, the hippocampus, or as you call it in the graphic novel, the archivist of the brain, is depicted as a seahorse typing away on a typewriter. And it's in this room surrounded by filing cabinets. And I'm wondering how you came up with these images. Do you draw on analogies and illustrations already common in scientific texts, Matteo?
Yes, actually, it's a very, well, not a metaphor, but that's where the name comes from. Probably, like, me being Italian kind of helps with the scientific names. Hippocampus is actually the seahorse, at least the Latin word for seahorse.
Why?
Because I guess it kind of looks like a seahorse. I mean, of course.
Yeah, the shape of it in the brain is like a, It's like a curled
structure. You have to use some imagination, but that's the actual name. So I thought, I recycle these metaphors, which that they are in scientific language, if it, maybe science are not aware of them, to actually like take them literally and turn them into characters.
Hannah, I've heard this phrase, the architecture of the brain. It's something we talk about a bit on this program. Now, you have in Neurocomic a typographical map of what you call Neuroland. Are you trying to introduce an element of fantasy into this exploration?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always to have like a map. I think both Matteo and I sort of obsessed with maps in general. I mean, I spend most of my PhD looking at connectivity between neurons and mapping them. And then it seems like a natural progression to have a neuro land in the book where we can also sort of guide the reader through different parts of the brain, so to speak.
Matteo, at the end of the book, the character wanders into some very deep territory regarding the meaning of the self and perception of our own identity. Now, these are not the sort of concepts that I think I've heard of in traditional texts about neuroscience and the brain, or are they?
The last chapters, it ends in a more philosophical territory. We wanted really to sort of briefly cover the whole span of neuroscience, which is a very wide subject. So we started to from the basis, from like anatomy, what's the brain made of, what are the cells, what they look like, how they are connected. But then we also wanted to touch to the more abstract idea in neuroscience, which in the end, they all rely on these cells. That's the thing that really fascinates me about the brain, that all, even this most complex things like consciousness, in the end, they all have to come from these cells. That was the idea, to show this connection.
Hannah, these are discussions that I'm guessing don't take place in the lab a lot.
Well, there's always the discussion of what is consciousness and can we understand it and can we find the sort of neural substrates of it. I think at the moment we're so far from achieving that I think it's important to still be able to talk about it in a sort of exciting way that we are still interested by it, but obviously that it remains one of sort of biggest frontiers that we still don't really understand.
I wonder if the creation of this graphic novel in a way was something that you wished you may have had when you were younger and first learning about the structures of the brain.
Definitely for me, yes. I grew up with this kind. I loved this sort of science illustrated textbook for children. I think that's what actually got me interested in science at first, because first I was interested in drawing, in art, and then I always loved this diagram, these complex diagrams and illustrations. So I couldn't really find anything similar for neuroscience, so I was trying to fill the gap.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel like I'm quite a visual person. If I see something visually, then I can understand it. Whereas if it's more sort of theoretical or conceptual, then I don't relate to it as much. So if I had had this when I was younger, I definitely would have really been grateful.
Well, Hannah Roche, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Matteo Farinella, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Farinella and Dr. Roche are authors of Neurocomic. It's a new graphic novel about how the brain works. Now, you can see some images from the book and check out the fantastic book trailer. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. When the Whitney Museum of Art acquired Douglas Davis's digital artwork, the world's first collaborative sentence back in 1995, there wasn't a conservation plan in place. After all, it's not like the work could fade or crack. But as the Whitney discovered, digital art decays in its own unique fashion. In 2011, the Whitney began the complicated process of restoring Davis's piece, which laid dormant since a server switch back in 2005. Milena Rysik is culture reporter for The New York Times. She joins us to talk about how conservationists restored a relic from the early days of the internet. Milena, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us about Douglas Davis's work, The World's First Collaborative Sentence.
Well, it's an artwork that he made in 1994. He was at the forefront of sort of technologically enhanced artwork. And at the time, it was really cutting edge. It allowed people to add a line or even a graphic image to a couple of sentences that he wrote that were written at the beginning. And it kind of functioned like a blog comment page does today. At the time, though, in 1994, this was really amazing technology.
Computer code doesn't decay like paintings and sculpture do, but it does become obsolete. So what's happened with this work?
Computer code actually decays very fast, to the surprise of a lot of artists and curators. So the Douglas Davis work just broke in a way that paintings and sculpture don't really, unless you smash them. I mean, it stopped functioning. You couldn't pull it up. It crashed your browser. You know, the text appeared as all this sort of garbled writing. It really didn't function at all.
So walk us through the restoration process and some of the questions that have come up in restoring this work.
The curators at the Whitney decided to put this work up about a year ago, and it took them a year to actually restore it because, first of all, when they went to look at it again, they realized it was broken. And second of all, they thought, well, we don't really know exactly how to fix this. I mean, our browsers and all of the things that we use to look at stuff on the internet have changed so much, even since 1995 when they got the work, that they had to get a special team of digital archivists, and it took them a year to do it. And as they were doing it, they started to unpack all these kind of philosophical questions about what makes a digital artwork tick in a way. You know, if you change the whole software underpinning of something like this, is it a different artwork? Does the way you present it visually, does that change its essential meaning as what the artist intended?
So what have they decided to do?
The Whitney did something that people in the art world don't really do, that it's very, very rare, and they decided to duplicate the artwork, and they made two versions of it, one that they left frozen in the way that it was when people last looked at it, although they made it sort of legible, and then they made one that looks the same, but you can add on to it.
So this brings up to me, you know, why not just, instead of restoring the Rodin, carve another one, you know, a duplicate? What is the rationale behind this?
Right. Well, it's something that we haven't really dealt with before with those kind of artworks. I mean, you'd like to assume that only Rodin can make another Rodin. But an artwork like this, which is conceptual and based on code that is relatively easy to reproduce, you know, compared to like a Picasso, you can do that. So it brings up this whole host of questions of what makes this artwork unique, what is its value, especially now that the technology that was its underpinning is sort of very commonplace. You know, how does that affect the sort of context of this artwork? Museums and cultural conservators are all really worried about what they're going to do because the volume of stuff that is born online is increasing. And at the same time, they don't really necessarily have the teams in place, the expertise in place quite yet to deal with it.
Douglas Davis's work, the world's first collaborative sentences, you mentioned one of the first pieces of art using the internet as a medium. What does make it so special and one worth spending more than a year restoring?
Well, the curators at the Whitney feel that it was a real visionary artwork. And in a way, it prefigured a lot of the way that we use the web now. I mean, 200,000 comments appeared from people all over the world on this thing. And it really prefigured how we use the web today, you know, in making comments and making our voices heard and in bridging these gaps of geography and time and space. This is what we think of as normal now. But at the time, it was really forward thinking.
So have you added anything new to the sentence?
You know what? I did. I did add on to the live version of the resurrected sentence. I wrote a line on there that said, "Will this exist in perpetuity?" ? And, you know, it doesn't have an answer, but it's out there. So I guess we'll find out.
Mylena Ryzik, staff reporter for The New York Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now you can find much more on digital art restoration, including Mylena's article, at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending a little bit of your weekend with Word of Mouth. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more on Monday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.